Well, we'll see. My name is Chris Wachnick, alcoholic. I am nervous right now. The train just keeps coming by. It'll block out. So I want to say thank you to Jerry. Thank you for inviting me to be here again. And thank you to the committee. You guys are doing a phenomenal job. A phenomenal job. I was telling someone before, I feel so nervous because you guys know me and know, if I cut someone off in the parking lot last week or if I yelled at someone or was rude in a meeting, I can't pull the wool over your guys' eyes. Not that I'm in the practice of doing that, so I have this habit of I've never shared this with anyone. I have this habit of when the opportunity comes to get to do this, I'll go and if I'm by myself, I'll sit in my truck and I'll listen to because I want to get spiritual before I come here, so I'll go and I'll listen to contemporary Christian music for 20 minutes and be like, yes, God, yes, and I get all super dramatic, so that's what I was doing in the parking lot before coming in, and I want to say too, if you don't like my pitch, you can always just refer to me as the other Chris, and we'll let him have that. Anyhow, so my sobriety date is September 22nd, 2006. My home group I have a couple home groups. So my home group is the Vicious Cycle Men's Book Study on Tuesday nights here in town. And I haven't really been able to be there in almost a year. And so my other home group is Suit Up and Show Up, 6:45 a.m. I have a sponsor, and he knows that he's my sponsor, which is important. That's an important part of this. So I feel like I was driving home from work yesterday, and I was like, dude, what am I going to talk about? Everyone here knows me, has heard rattle my gums, for the last few years, and I was thinking, what could I do different? I'm just going to tell a different story of my life, a different version, I don't really know a different version, so I'm just stuck with what you get. So anyhow, I'm just going to do my best to share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys. And it's such a huge privilege for me to get to be here. It's a huge privilege. And I hope that if you're new or, thinking about being new or, maybe a little dry, that if I don't say it again, over the course of the next 3 or 4 hours, that this is about God's grace. Alcoholics Anonymous has been the revelation of a greater power's grace in my life, and the application of that grace in my life. And I hope that you hear that, and I believe it's been my experience that if you come here and you do the things that are suggested in our big book, and you come all the way in and you sit all the way down, that you'll get to experience that grace as well. That's been my experience, and that's my hope for you, if you're sitting here tonight. So, I sorry, dude, I just coughed on you. We're super good friends now. It's funny that I got asked to be the hometown speaker because I'm not actually from here, and I barely live here now. I was born in Northern California and grew up in a pretty stable home. Mom and dad were together, and I have a younger sister. And I should say this too, because it always stinks when you hear someone take someone else's. If you hear something from me that you've heard somewhere else, and you're like, dude, that's not your original stuff. I feel like that's how we communicate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, someone may say something, and I hear it, and I'm like, oh my God, I identify with that. And then it comes out later in another meeting, and maybe I put it and paint it with some of my words. So if you hear something that sounds plagiarized, it totally is. It's plagiarized. Because that's my experience here in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that you guys often know me better than I know myself. And vice versa, right? I heard this guy say this a few years ago. He was like, I have the uncanny ability to see people's problems and see a clear solution for them. He goes, but I have this strange blind spot to those same problems in my own life. And man, I identify with that. So, if you see me come up to you and I start telling you what you should do, pay attention. It's the solution. Anyhow, I grew up north. I feel like I had a pretty normal childhood. There wasn't abuse, physical or sexual abuse in my family life. We were like a go to church on Sunday kind of family, and things were good. Like my mom was a stay at home mom. My dad worked for the federal government, and my sister she's this incredible human being, and you know, and we would fight and bicker and stuff as kids. But what I really struggled with was I'm inherently lazy, and I really struggled to, especially when I was younger, to just sit still. And if I wasn't interested in something, man, I was like, it was like pulling teeth to just sit still. And school was like that for me. And it wasn't like that for my sister. She was incredible, like straight A's, and this is the type of person that she is. I was talking to her a couple years ago, and she was like, "Yeah, I got into it with someone at work, and I realized that I was wrong, and I had to call her and make it right, and ask her if there was anything else that I could do." And I was like, "Where did you learn that?" And she's like, "Oh, that's just normal. That's just what you do, right, when you're wrong." And I was like, "What?" Like, I did not come stock with that built in. So my dad and I started to struggle in our relationship pretty early on, you know, because I had a hard time paying attention and sitting still, and that wasn't okay with him. And he was doing the best that he could as a dad. He was an awesome father. And, you know, for years I blamed him for my life. And I blamed my sister, you know, she got straight A's. How unfair this is to me. You know, how dare you do well in life? And I blamed my family. I blamed school. But that was a place of contention between my dad and I. And so pretty early on I started to form this resentment towards my old man. And I never felt that he liked me, and I could hear the words like "I love you, son," but I never felt like that was for me. And that wasn't because that That's just not true. My dad did love me, and he was doing the very best that he could. But I started to shape this resentment, and I started to sharpen it at a really, like, probably like 8 or 9. And I started to build up this victim story of how I have been done wrong, how I don't fit in. And I had this daydream that I actually was adopted and was never really actually a part of my family because I was just so different than them. And so what I did was I found validation, and I found a sense of belonging, and ultimately, like, what I was seeking was love. And I found that in my friends on the street that I grew up with, building forts and jumping bikes and riding skateboards and stuff. And what I found was that if you're willing to do, like, the most wild stuff, I got approval from that. I got this, like, man, dude, you're crazy. You're going to jump off that into that pool? You're nuts. And that fed this thing inside of me that I believed was love and approval and belonging. But the thing with that is, and what I found, is that there always needs to be something else, something bigger, something more, because it's not sustainable. And so I started to shape this paradigm where I built this resentment and this victim story with my family, and I invested in quick burn sense of approval from friends and then essentially strangers. And so when I was 14, we moved from Northern California to Ohio, and that was a shocker, right? So it, like, we couldn't afford to live in Ohio coming from up there, and so we lived at a Forest Service station out by the lake. And you'd think, oh dude, how wonderful must have that been. I resented, like, that was the final for me in my relationship with my dad, that he didn't like me, I didn't do well in school, he wasn't really an athlete, and I tried to play a lot of sports, and he wasn't really keen on sports. And then you're going to move us from Northern California to Southern California, and I resented him for years behind that. And that was the fuel that I used. I played the perpetual victim. And really what my dad was doing the very best that he could to take care of his family. The very best. He didn't want to move. And we moved to a place where we were strangers and we didn't know anyone. And he did that to take care of us. And I didn't self-centeredly, I didn't even recognize that. Not that you would be all that developed at 14, but like I was thinking about how bad this was for me. And so that belief system that I had developed, that I could get a quick burn sense of approval or belonging from some friends, really kicked in. And that first year of high school for me, I tried some sports. I didn't make the team. That, like, broke my heart. And because I wasn't good enough. Not because they didn't like me or I didn't fit in, but because I wasn't up to that level of athleticism. But I blamed them. And I blamed the school. And I blamed my family. And there's this resentment just getting sharpened and honed. And that first year of high school, what I discovered was that I could crack jokes and make noises in class and throw spitwads and I'd get a laugh. And that felt like that same thing, like when we were kids and we were doing bike jumps and we were jumping off of bridges into the river or off of somebody's house into a pool. And so that was my sense of, man, here I am. They're laughing. They like me. I'm approved of. I belong. And so it wasn't not a far step. My first year of high school, when someone asked me, I had this summer job, and dude, I was like miserable. I feel like I'm skipping all around, but I was pretty miserable. I was really angry at my dad. I was just an angry young man, and I was trying to kind of fit in and blaming the world. And I had this summer job at an old folks' home in downtown Ojai. And it was in the basement. And it was super hot and miserable in there. And nurses could still smoke inside. And it had like this blue haze through the basement. And I worked as a dietary aide in the kitchen. And this guy that I worked with asked me one day, he's like, "Hey, do you smoke pot?" And I was like, "Yeah, I smoke pot, dude." And I had not smoked pot before. But I thought, like, you know, I heard this... I heard a guy say this one time. He was like, they asked him, "Hey, do you smoke weed and do you drink?" And he didn't hear, "Do you smoke weed, do you drink?" He heard, "Do you want to hang out with us?" And, I didn't hear that for like 30 years later. But man, I identify with that. "Do you smoke pot?" "Yeah, heck yeah, I do. What do we do?" And so the next day he brought some marijuana and we smoked it. And I messed up a bunch of those old folks' diets, and we laughed, and I rode this crummy 10-speed to where my dad was going to pick me up in his pickup, and I went home, and I just listened to reggae, and I was like, surely I am not part of this family. And I had this dialogue going on in my head that... So this is pretty for me, this was a turning point in my life. Let me back up a second. So a couple years before that, I had this experience in junior high and before we moved to Southern California of standing out in front of the school by the lockers, and I was talking with like three or four friends one morning before school started, and I just remember like, I didn't feel part of the conversation. And I started to think about what they were thinking about what I was saying and what other people were thinking about what I was wearing. And it was, you know, it was like 1980 something, so like red Converse high tops, pegged Levi's, the Levi jacket with the collar popped up, and I had a 57 Gumby t-shirt on that had like puffy paint on it, and I thought I was so cool. But I was super worried about what you thought about me and how I was standing, and was my collar flipped up right? And that internal dialogue completely took me out of being present with those friends. And Billy and I have talked about this a couple times. Like, dude, that happens for me now. Like, before the meeting started, and I was sitting in the chair, and I was like, I usually wear Vans, but I'm wearing dress shoes. Is anyone going to notice? They probably won't like me because I'm wearing dress shoes, and I usually wear Vans. And I didn't bring my glasses, and that's okay, but will someone know? And so if I don't watch it, I will pay into that internal conversation. And I'll completely remove myself from being right here and being right now. And I could be surrounded with you guys, and I am utterly alone with myself and my thoughts. And the scary thing is that the more I value that conversation, the more I listen to it, the further I get away from not only you guys, but the further I get away from God. And that doesn't serve me very well. So I was having this if you're new and you're here and you're like, "Yeah, I got like 2 weeks or 30 days or a year and like pretty soon all my defects are gonna go away." Yep. Just like, my experience has been some of that stuff has gone away. And some of that stuff I've recognized it now much quicker than I recognized it before. So, that's why that's why we continue to meet. And that's why we work with new people. That's why we have these honest relationships with our sponsor or sponsor quality friendships with one another. Because sometimes I don't see it. Sometimes I don't even realize that I'm listening to the voice. And you guys are like, dude, what are you listening to? Christian music. So we moved to Southern California, and I was having this internal dialogue, and obviously, like, I did not know that that was going on then. But years later, through the process of working the steps, I've, like, remembered that morning in junior high. And I was like, wow, I was dominated by that for years. So, living in Ojai and smoked marijuana for the first time, and that internal chatter that I had going on, that very first time it started to get quiet. And I was like, man, I'm in. I am in on this. It didn't go away completely, but it made a pretty good dent. And it was just a couple months later that a couple guys that I went to school with, they were a few years older than me, asked me if I wanted to go out on a Friday night. And I knew, like, going out on a Friday night meant that we were gonna drink. And I had not been drunk before. And I had, like, tried beer, and my family, like, my grandpa on my mom's side was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the 50s, and so they were, you know, my grandma and my mom would tell me, you must not drink, and I, in my mind, I was like, I absolutely will, and because it, you guys say it's so bad, it must be that good. So I had tried a couple, like, we had stolen some beer and shotgunned it, but I'd never gotten buzzed up or drunk. And so that Friday night, my sophomore year of high school, I went out with a couple of buddies, and I've shared this with you guys. So I don't, like, there's no tough guy, there's no, like, Jack Daniels story or moonshine for me. We were riding around downtown Ojai in, like, a late 70s Mustang hatchback. And I had 4 citrus wine coolers. And, but, right, dude, it's almost embarrassing. The only thing that would be worse is if it was Zima. But whatever gets you here, if Zima gets you here. The thing that makes us different, that makes me different from my fellows, that makes me bodily and mentally different from my fellows, happened that night. As I worked my way through that 4-pack of citrus wine coolers, and I started to feel the physical effects, and then I started to feel the mental effects of liquor. And the voice inside my head that was so concerned about what you thought about me, and what did you think about what I was saying and what I'm wearing and how I'm standing? Should I have one hand in my pocket or two? Is this okay? Do you like me? Should I even be here? It was gone. And I was at home with the guys that I was with and running around Ojai. I'd never even really smoked cigarettes before, but all of a sudden that night I was huffing down Marlboro Reds. And we went by the high school and the homecoming, like, all the athletes, the football team was coming back with the cheerleaders, and I was could talk to the cheerleaders and was lining stuff up, and I was funny, and I wasn't concerned with me. That's how I felt. I felt like I got free, and I made a commitment. I made a commitment that I didn't, like, speak it out loud, and I don't, like, remember saying it even to myself, but I made a commitment. I am going to do this as often as I possibly can, regardless of what it costs. I'm in. I'm all in. As I got some relief from alcohol. And so that's what I did the rest of my high school years. I went all in. And I didn't just go in all in with alcohol. I went all in with whatever. You know, whatever was available. If it was booze stolen out of Vons, great. If it was my buddy's brother's homemade beer, cool. If it was a bottle of whiteout that he stole from the office, that'll work. Whatever will take me out of being present right now and give me that sense of relief. And so that was what I did through high school. And pretty quickly, my folks saw that I had a problem, and so I knew that it wasn't going to fly in their house, so I went back to Northern California and lived at my grandma's and ran wild and came back home 6 months later, and my folks picked me up in Oxnard at the train station, and they're like, "We've been seeing a family counselor. We want to stop at the counselor's office on the way home." I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. And it was Vista Del Mar was the counselor's office. And the juvenile facility at Vista Del Mar. And so they're like, "We just want to talk to your family for a second. Just go in this room." And then I was like, okay. And then the room had like leather straps on it. And they closed the door and there was a window like this. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not leaving here. And so I stayed there for a while and I escaped. And then I called my dad for a ride because I was scared on the avenue. And big tough guy. And he came and picked me up and took me right back. And then the next year I went to Steps down in Wainimi. And I escaped there. And it came back because I got scared down there too. My senior year of high school, I had gone back to Northern California because that was kind of my MO. Like, the problem is the school district, the principal, my mom and dad, my sister in Ojai, I'll go up north. And then I'd be up there and I was like, dude, the sheriffs up here are unreasonable. I'm going back down south. So that was kind of my MO. I'd come down here, I'd go to rehab, I'd make it to a handful of meetings, and that's where I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember at Steps, they would van us around. They'd take us around the county to these different meetings, and sometimes other fellowship, and sometimes here with us. And I think it was around that time that I came to my very first roundup. And there was like a dance, and it was pretty awesome. I mean, I didn't think it was awesome then, but it was pretty awesome. I got toted around by a couple sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would take me to meetings, and they would take me to Caro's, and we would drink coffee and smoke cigarettes, and I would never stay sober because I would never get a sponsor, I would never read the book, and I would never work a step. Ever. I was not going to do that. And so I didn't stay sober. And so, you know, back to Northern California, back into rehab, back down here. And as my alcoholism progressed, so did the things that I was willing to do to get alcohol and drugs. Was a beer run on a Friday night at Vaughn's, or, you know, Jet Liquor or whatever, you know, turned into, you know, oh, is that garage door open? Let's check. And to cars. And so my criminal behavior increased as my alcoholism increased. When I went back to Northern California in 1992, I got arrested for the first time and spent like 3 days in jail. And I did a bunch of push-ups, and I thought I was tough. And I spent the next few years just in and out of, because I knew that there was something here. I knew that there was something in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I wasn't willing to do. Wouldn't even ask, really. Like, I knew there were steps in a book. My deal was I liked the stories in the back of the book. There was this one story in the third edition called Five-Time Loser Wins, and I loved that story because the dude went to prison, and I was like, dude, that is so awesome. That dude is killer. And I would read, like, the first part of the stories, but I would never, like, really follow up where they got sober. I was just in the problem, and I was like, man, these guys are amazing. So in the 90s, that was my MO, back and forth, late 80s, 90s, back and forth, everyone else is the problem, not me. I had a taste of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I wasn't willing to do the thing. And in 1996, I went back to Northern California, a raging alcoholic. And I had this idea that I was going to go on a skateboard road trip construction job through the western United States. And I had nothing. I was like getting unemployment deposited in my bank account, and I had no plan. And my plan was to get drunk. That was my plan. And I got back to Northern California, and in less than a week, I got a DUI. So the road trip was done. And a couple months after that, I broke my leg drunk out on a lake. So now I had doctor visits to go to, and I wasn't mobile. And my willingness to do whatever I could to stay drunk and loaded just kept getting lower and lower. The things that I would tell myself, I'd never do that. It was like, no one really knows. Who cares? It's not a big deal. They're not in my shoes. And so in October of 1996, a friend of mine and I went out to shoot pool, and we decided to rob someone. And in the process of committing a robbery, we committed a homicide. And 6 days later, we were arrested and put in the county jail in Northern California. And a year and a half after that, I was sentenced to 25 years to life in California State Prison. And you would think, like, surely that's enough. Like, that's enough, dude. You need help. Cry out for help. And I don't think like that. I don't think consequentially. My ideas are, when left to myself, I'm listening to that internal voice. What do you think of me? How do I fit in? And I don't even consider the consequences or who I've hurt, how I've devastated families. And I think about, this isn't really my fault. And, dude, that's shameful. And so I thought I would find a solution in a relationship with God, but I had no idea what a real relationship with God even looked like. And so I got into some religious stuff, and I started like attending chapel services, which is great. Like, if that's, you know, for some people that might work. But what I wouldn't do, what I refused to do, was the same thing that I always refused to do. I would not take an honest, thorough look at myself and take responsibility for my actions, for my thinking. And so, in 1996, I was arrested. In 1998, I was sentenced to prison. And I managed somehow to put together 5 years without a drink or a drug in prison. And I was doing like some positive stuff and involved with some spiritual practices and reading positive literature, but I was never taking an honest evaluation of who I was. And as a result, I got super uncomfortable. And that voice of, do they like me? Do I fit in here? How am I standing? Am I wearing the right clothes? Like, I mean, even in prison, like, I would ask myself, am I wearing the right clothes right now? So goofy. So I got super uncomfortable, and in 2001, a friend of mine walked by and was like, hey, do you want a pill? And I was like, yeah, I'll take a pill. And I took a couple pills. And that made me feel better. And then a couple weeks later, someone asked, hey, do you want to smoke some pot? I was like, heck yeah. And then a few weeks later, I decided that I would try drinking. And so I started drinking. homemade booze in prison. And then I thought, well, dude, I'm like right here where there's all this other stuff that makes you really relaxed and slows you way down. I'm going to give that a shot. And so I did that. And I made that commitment again. Dude, this is so good. I'm going to do this as often as I possibly can, regardless of who it hurts, what it costs. And so for the next 6 years, I completely invested my life in that. All the stuff that, you know, that you think about or that you hear about, prisons, gangs, and violence, and trafficking, narcotics, all that, I got involved with all that stuff. And I was like a, I just got involved with all that stuff, and because I can talk a little bit, go talk, and I'm at the front of the bus, and that sense of validation and approval and belonging, that ridiculous craving for more and more and more, just grew, and I couldn't get enough of what I thought was loyalty and commitment, and all of it was false, all of it. And I invested myself in that. But the crazy thing is that there I was with, oh, you should answer that. It's probably. Dude, no big deal. That happens. It's happened to me. So, I had this seed of Alcoholics Anonymous planted in my brain. And so every few months or like maybe a couple times a year, I'd have like a rough day or a rough week, and I'd be sad. And I'd go to like, maybe I'd go to church, and I'd be like, God, please help me. And then I'd go get loaded. I'd go get drunk. And there was these little windows where I had the opportunity to take action, and I wouldn't. Like, you know where you feel like broken inside, and like something's got to change. Man, I got to do something. And then if I don't act on that, because I don't have the willpower. The willpower for me doesn't, I don't have that when I'm disconnected from a greater power. So in 2005, I was out on the yard. I was talking to a buddy of mine, and I knew he was sober. I had been at a different prison with him a number of years before, and I was like, Charlie, I think I want to quit. And he, you know, he just told me, he was like, look, dude, you want to talk about handball, punk rock music, sports, skateboarding, whatever, guitars, I'm in. Let's talk about it all day. He goes, but I'm sober, you're not. You are not finished, so why don't you just shut up, because I don't want to hear you cry. And that sounds pretty harsh, right? But, and I was deeply offended. Because I'm a sensitive person. And I am super sensitive. I get my feelings hurt really easy. And that was just, how dare you? However, I can tell you, like, that was a pivotal conversation. And that hard-nosed, hard-lined Alcoholics Anonymous approach was one of several conversations that ultimately saved my life. And I'm grateful for him. Every year when my birthday rolls around, I call him. And I tell him, dude, thank you so much. Dude, you saved me. He's like, dude, shut up. I'm like, really, still? So I wasn't ready yet. And he saw right through me. And so I spent the next year, unbeknownst to me, I spent the next year researching what it was to be done. And I came back to him a year later, just broken, completely shattered. I'd been in and out of administrative segregation and under investigation, blah, 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 all this stuff. And I just came to him and was like, I need you, please help me. And he said, I'll sponsor you, dude. I'll take you to the steps. And that started something for me. That started a new life for me, is what happened. That started a new life for me. It wasn't perfect, but I started to learn about what honesty looks like, what rigorous honesty looks like, what I started to be able to have words for being, what desperation looks like, and getting into a solution. And it wasn't, like, by no means was it perfect. I had a slip up at 21 days, and a slip up. I relapsed at 21 days, and that's my sobriety day, September 22nd, 2006, the day before I relapsed. And so we started going. He was like, there's some meetings. Let's go to meetings. We're going to go to meetings, and we're going to work the steps. And so we started going to meetings, and there was two meetings. There was three meetings a week. One of them was the other program. Two of them were AA meetings. And we would go, and they would talk about stuff that wasn't AA. And so Charlie and I went in there, and we took, like, the meeting binder, this thing, and we just told them when they started to have the meeting, we told them, look, you guys aren't in charge anymore. This is how we're going to run the AA meeting. We're going to read the readings, and we're going to talk about a topic, which typically isn't how we do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a group conscience, and we vote. We don't just go in and take the binder. But I stayed sober, so there's something to be said about willingness. I got super involved in sobriety and in recovery, and at 4 years sober, I transferred from where I was in the Central Valley to Soledad State Prison. And when I got there, there was this amazing Alcoholics Anonymous community. There was like five or six meetings a week, and there was, on Wednesdays you could go twice. And so I just threw myself in, and I still didn't really know what I was doing. Like, I had worked the steps with Charlie out of this workbook, and we had done the best that we could, and I got there, and I got a new sponsor, and I started going to all these meetings, and I there was an Al-Anon meeting that had just started, and I was like, I'll go to that, that's cool. And I went to Al-Anon, and I got a little view of what I had put my mom through, and from her perspective, which was an incredible gift. And later that year, my dad passed away from terminal cancer. And you guys allowed me and gave me the tools to walk through that and to process that. And it was a couple years later that I was attending a meeting one night, and these guys came in, and they would say their first and last name. They would always have their book with them. And they would stand up and they'd say, I'm so-and-so alcoholic. And I was like, okay. And then they would always, like, talk about the first 164 pages of the book. And I was like, dude, relax. Calm down. And then they started talking about how they had gone across the country, and they were starting these conferences, getting ready for 2020, right? We're going to have the World Convention in Detroit, and they're like, yeah, we're doing this thing called the Road to Detroit, and it's amazing. We go to, like, these weird little towns in the Midwest, and we start these weekend 3-day conferences, and I was like, dude, we should do that in prison. And they're like, what? We've never heard of such a thing. We're going to go talk to our sponsor, and we'll get back to you next month, because they were like the second Tuesday of the month rotation on the H&I panel, guys. And so I was like, oh, well, I can't wait a month. I can't even sit still in math class. So I went and, like, the sponsor for, like, the liaison through the prison administration to us was the warden secretary, and I went and talked to her, and she was like, oh my gosh, that sounds like a great idea. Write out an agenda of what it would look like and get, like, a committee together, and I'll push it through. I'll get it approved for you guys. And so these guys came back, and they're like, dude, our sponsor had never heard of a three-day conference in prison. We're going to have to talk to the grand sponsor. And I was like, we got approved to have a three-day conference in prison. And so in 2016, we got to have, to my knowledge, the first three-day Alcoholics Anonymous conference at Soledad State Prison. It was phenomenal. And one of my good friends is here tonight, and I was from out of town, and he was there. And let me tell you something. To get to sponsor a guy in prison and then get to sponsor him out here, what a gift, dude. What a gift. I walked right by him earlier, and he was like, dude, you don't recognize me? And I'm like, no, dude, we're not standing next to each other in the shower. I didn't recognize you. So, anyhow. So, what happened at Soledad was from these H&I guys coming in and sharing this meeting with us and sharing their experience with us, we took hold of it. A bunch of dudes in blue took hold of it and started something. And it just, like, took off and went crazy. And there was, like, guys sponsoring guys, men sponsoring men in prison, reading the big book, doing fist steps out on our prison yard. It was phenomenal. And we got to start meetings and all this stuff. Like, it was like living in the first 164 pages of the book. I mean, I know that sounds arrogant. I don't mean it like that. But I don't know how else to describe it. It was the most insane experience. And in 2017, I got to go to the parole board for the first time. And as a direct result of the application of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to my life, that I went in there to take responsibility for my life. Not to try to hide anything or make excuses, but to own the choices that I had made and the person that I was, and to just... to make an amends to the community and the families that I had ripped apart. And they decided that that I was ready to come home. And like 4.5 months later, I got to walk out of prison after 21 years, 1 month and 15 days. And my mom and one of my good family friends and my nephew came and picked me up. And we drove home, and the Thomas Fire was in full force. I paroled on December 7th, 2017. And I was in a meeting on Wednesday in Soledad Prison. Thursday morning I paroled. And Thursday night at 5 o'clock I was at the Ohio Lano Club. And my experience has been that you guys have taken a hold of me. You gave me a place to land, and you gave me the tools and the direction that I needed to become a community member. And to be a good son, and to be a brother, and to be a partner, to be a friend. You guys have shown that to me. I have a bunch of moms. I mean, I have one mom, but I have a bunch of moms. And I have a few dads here. And I have a couple sponsees that call me dad. And I'm like, dude, I am not that much older than you. And then you've entrusted me with to be part of this. You know, to be part of this. And this has been like, I came to my first one in 2018 down in Oxnard with my sponsor Dan and I came, and it was an incredible experience. And the following year, I got to get involved on the committee, and I know from firsthand experience that, like, this is an amazing experience. This weekend is an amazing weekend, and like the networking and the community building that happens, and the service works that happen. The people that are on the committee and volunteering and involved are having this incredible experience. And there's one person, Jerry, who's having a different experience than everyone else. I mean it. Like, when you... there's a different experience. It's a different experience. And so I wouldn't implore you, get involved, throw yourself into it, come all the way in and sit all the way down. So I'm going to wrap it up, and I appreciate doesn't even come close to you know, the gratitude that I feel to get to be here and get to share a little bit of my story and to get to be involved with this roundup. And, you know, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm free today, and you guys gave me the tools to get free 17 plus years ago. And that's something for a person like me. That's something for people like us to get to be free. To get some relief from that internal chatter and to find purpose and usefulness in our lives and have meaning, right? And get to experience God's grace and then get to share that with other people. So I mean it when I say it. I'm thank you for my life, and thank you for a life worth living, and for giving me purpose. Thanks.